Hello and welcome to the Maverick Radio Hour. I'm your host, GT Maverick, coming to you from Westport, Kansas City on a rainy day on October 27th, 2021. And I'm not kidding, it really is, it's coming down out there, and apparently it's going to keep coming for most of the day, perhaps tomorrow too. Fortunately, we have this thing called rain that tends to wash away the dirt and grime that tends to accumulate. It's quite an amazing thing. In one of my poems, A Frog Sees the Lightning, this is something that I always I thought was very curious about weather patterns, particularly rain itself. Say if you're a frog and you were a tadpole and you grew up in the water and you'd never been, that's all you'd known when you were through your whole life, until you get to some point where you grow those legs and you get out of the pond and step out of that little puddle and go on to land. Not only are you breathing air as opposed to using some sort of gills that they have, what exactly is the mechanism by which the tadpole works like that? I don't know. It's very fascinating stuff. Nonetheless, eventually you get out of the water and you get onto land, and it really is fascinating that certainly from perspective as a human being, that water falls from the sky. It's if you take a step back for a minute and just jump into this world like you're an alien coming from another universe or another galaxy or something like that, or let's say you're a some sort of conscious being that doesn't really have the type of body that we normally do, and you're thrown into this world, it's quite incredible. It really is. And for a frog, that would be something else. I mean, the medium with which you actually lived within for your life, part of that ends up falling from the sky in little droplets. It's quite fascinating. And it's one of the aspects of our universe that is quite amazing. And I think that's what we're going to look at today, is that life indeed finds a way. It really does. And there's aspects of this when it comes to physics and cosmology that I find incredibly fascinating. Because there's the sense that you have this, let's look at life itself and throw on some pertinent parameters and metrics that sort of define it. Not necessarily the, we'll try to go to the base level, that is to say, and see that it's a, life is a replicating, self-replicating thing. So it makes more of itself, and it perpetuates in a in space and time. So all dimensions that we have, we live within, and that's where life lives as well. Now, even if you're like an amoeba or something, you might not have much a sense of the vertical world. So you might be missing out on a dimension or two. Nonetheless, that's where we live. And life is this self-replicating tendency. And we're carbon-based forms, and we have this biology that is formed of this. But that would also, the self-replicating nature of it, is indicative of there being that life. The metrics, like we have skin and we're mammals and that sort of thing, are kind of window dressing in a lot of ways. If you look at that, the possibility that you can have like silicon-based life, or you can have life based on things like hydrocarbons, more so than water that we utilize on our front, or life that would breathe some other gas that would be prevalent on other planets. But what happens with it, and what we've noticed certainly from our limited perspective. This one Earth, this one planet, and this is the only place we know for sure that actually that has life. But really, I mean, come on, people. we know that it's going to be. It's quite likely, quite common throughout the universe. Now, it's going to look different in other places, and we might have a hard time finding it because it's going to be different from us and from what we've seen before. But nonetheless, it will have the. We will know it by the fact that it reproduces itself and creates copies of sorts, mixes and passes on, and goes to and continues and perpetuates doing that. Now, it doesn't stop very easily. We haven't seen this end. We've seen through the geological records, and this one after another of events where so much of it's been wiped out, so much of it's been destroyed, volcanic events, asteroids, particularly here on Earth. Sometimes you have things like diseases. Now, at that, you can look at the evolutionary biology behind diseases, by the way. And the thing is, I'm not here to scare any of y'all. That's one thing I'd like to put out there as well, prior to and during, you know, these sort of discussions, these extemporaneous verbal essays that I like to repeat, is that I'm not here to scare or turn anyone into a fearful being. They say fear can sharpen the mind in some manners, and sometimes it can. But when you're living in a civil society, as we have for the most part, it's unnecessary, quite unnecessary. And when you allow it to take over you, you really stop yourself from living the life that you were given and exploring and enjoying the great things that it has to offer. So I'm not here to scare you. At the same time, there are things like this that do happen, and I would recommend that rather than being scared about it much of the time, unless you have some sort of strategic or tactical rationale for how you're acting and how you're looking at the world, in a lot of ways, it's more enjoyable, this life, to be as if one was the moth seeking after the light. And if you're a moth and you're chasing after the flame, and there's a flame there, and it's actually going to burn you when you get there, well, while you're going toward that light, toward that flame, and you end up going into it and it burns you right up, the best way in that occasion is not for the moth to keep his distance and not to follow the instinctual and reasoned urges that the moth has, but to just go into the flame anyway. You might get burned, you might not. But if you hold back, then you'll never know. And it'll always be a question. As they say, you regret most of the things you don't do in life. So go out and do them. And this is something I mentioned in last week's episode, that at the end, before the sign-off, I mentioned, go out and do what you wish. You know, that's stepping into a new world, that's ultimately what we have to offer. And this ties into a few other things. But go out there and do what you wish, do what you like. And there's a loud bang, crash, 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 crash. Lots of times when I hear that, there's a... When you get that... you might call it feedback from the universe, it tends to make a note in my mind. And I would encourage y'all to keep an eye out for those sorts of things, because it's very, very fascinating. Once you start seeing it, then you can't unsee it, and it'll lead you to some very interesting places. And that's what so much of what life has to offer us too. Each one of those is an extra light, an extra flame for us to see at the very least, and observe, and possibly to chase after and go after. So, going back to life itself and the fact that it does find a way in this front, you can see that there's a that want and drive within us to make more, to procreate, is that's what defines us. It's wonderful. It's great. And there's a sense that even through these disasters, and the evolutionary biology aspect when it comes to plagues, is that considering that life wants to, and this is the point, it wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here. Nothing, no life would be here to even observe itself were it not for the deep desire and drive to make more, to extend that lineage, for us to pass on our DNA. And that applies to all forms of life as well. So this is the methodology by which life operates. And you look at the evolutionary biology aspect of this, and in our case, the psychology. You look at the biological aspect of this when it comes to viruses and the hosts that viruses inhabit, also bacteria and others. Bacteria to a little bit less extent, but viruses particularly, is that if they destroy the host, if they're excessively deadly, then they will not spread. Because what will happen is the host will die, and thus the virus will, being that it's contained in that dead body in this case, it's not necessarily going to spread. Sometimes it can, but for the most part, this is how we might say plagues are a, for viruses and for us, a self-regulating mechanism. And so we see that now with what happened with COVID. We didn't know what it was going to be at first, but we've known now, and it's clear that it's not that deadly. And as this thing wants to perpetuate itself, it's going to be, it becomes less deadly as it becomes what they call endemic. So every day that we go out and live our lives and interact and be amongst each other and do our things, it becomes less an issue. It becomes less a problem. And this is the case with all viruses. Unless something has changed to the virus theory that we've been running with for the last 100 years plus, but it would appear that that is still holding up as far as I can tell. And so that is something to keep in mind, and something to tamp down that fear, that ever present, that whether there's it comes from a deeper place or whether it gets pumped into us through various means in order to control us. Keep that in mind, that life itself and the interactions that we have with things like viruses are self-regulating mechanisms that, for it to perpetuate itself in the manner that it makes more, it needs to be less deadly. And it finds that out through a trial and error process. And this is what evolution ultimately comes down to. Now, evolution, when it comes to human beings, I don't think this is necessarily something that totally defines us, because there is a divine aspect to our lives and the spiritual and mental and material world that we occupy that is not purely run by the robotic mechanisms, or not robotic, but mechanistic mechanisms of evolutionary biology. And you can look into that deeper, and the more you do, the more you realize that there is more to us than evolution can really explain in its entirety. Where we came from, what we do, why it is what we do, and the also the ability for us to make decisions on our own. as opposed to simply being the effects of the cause of instinctual urges. We have the ability to reflect upon those instinctual urges and decide where we're going to go and what we're going to do. Now, this brings up the idea of cause and effect itself. So then we wonder, okay, well, if cause and effect is the whole way in which this world works. You know, I bring up Newton's laws often enough, and you look at his second law, every action has equal opposite reaction. So if you look at that and you start with a cause somewhere, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or at the beginning of the universe, or wherever, ultimately it's arbitrary to see where that line is that you're like, okay, I'm going to pick that spot. Some line at which to find. Ultimately, it's arbitrary where we look on that historical perspective in the time frames that we utilize in order to check through those causes and find those effects. Because ultimately, they're chains in this, at least in the mechanistic theory itself, which leads to people saying, oh, well, we don't have free will. Well, the thing is, we do, because that's not the whole story. Now, it does explain things very well in a real-world, physical operating action sort of manner. Namely, like I said, that second law there, that you hit the billiard ball in this spot and it's going to go over in that other it's going to go at the angle at a certain angle dependent on where you hit it, that sort of thing, and the amount of force you apply. But you get down to a deeper level, and then these things, you know, don't make sense anymore. In the real world, where we can touch and what we can see ourselves, it does. But you get down to those other, to these deeper levels, and all of a sudden, that's not enough. It really isn't. Not necessarily all of a sudden. It's kind of gradual. But and as you go down and you look deeper into this sort of thing, you find out that the cause and effect continuum, as we could call it, doesn't make sense. You get down to the quantum level, and similar to how that quantum world is it seemingly random. You don't know whether this particular, in a statistical sense, you can say that this collection of particles is likely going to act in a certain manner, and you could put a percentage to that, a likelihood, statistical likelihood, based on what you've observed in the past. But actually picking out one of them and saying that this one is going to do this thing when you hit it with an electron at this particular angle or something like that, that's not determinable. It doesn't work like that. The billiard balls at that level don't go exactly at the at an angle that is consistent on singular particles. So, what does that mean? What that means is that at some level, the cause and effect continuum is broken. At some level, cause and effect is not sufficient. In order to direct cause and effect isn't sufficient in order to explain the phenomena that we witness. So this is how free will comes about, and the way it does is that the cause and effect and the mechanistic manner with which our instinctual selves and the way our bodies operate interacts with the quantum world, where our ultimate spirits can have effect upon that mechanistic world. And that is a each one of these little spirits, you might say, has a randomness, because bringing this to a neurological level, if there's a electrical signal, one small electrical signal that you can identify as being the locus for a larger thought. Like, for instance, let's say that the thought comes to my mind, oh, I'm hungry, okay? Now, where does that come from, and how does it express itself? So the body will send these signals, the brain in its connection to checking on the state of yourself, how your body's functioning. You get some signals from the stomach. Stomach sends a signal up to the brain, and brain says to your conscious mind, eventually you realize that you're hungry. Or let's say there's a small little pain that you get in your arm or something, or any number of small ideas that pop out of nowhere. So these happen all the time. And there's a certain likelihood that a small electric signal will just happen of its own. Will just pop out, and ooh, all of a sudden you're thinking that you're hungry. Even though your brain didn't necessarily receive that signal from your stomach. Let's say that there was an electrical discharge nearby. Let's say, I mean, right now it's still raining. If a bolt of lightning comes down half a mile away, there is a possibility that through the air there's an electrical discharge and production of ozone and a slight change in the density and positive electromagnetic shift in the atmosphere that affects the oxygen particles that you're breathing in that then have an effect upon your red blood cell that's sent, ran through the vessels, blood vessels, into your brain that touched on a dendrite that happened to be a little bit out of the proper pH that would normally have the functioning, running normal functioning of the body, such that there was a slight short circuit in that neuron that caused that idea. Now, at the same time, you go a little deeper than that, and you realize that there's a certain percentage likelihood that there's an electrical signal that could pop off at any time that could change the course of your life, that could alter what you've been doing. Let's say you've been running, you're in the middle of a 5-mile run, and 2 miles in, you see something that stops you on the road. And suddenly you stop on that road, and then you see the thing, and you forget about that 5-mile run. Or let's say there's an accident on the road or something, and so you stop to help out the people. This is how free will really comes about. And so these little accidents these little accidents that are aggregated in our mind that may or may not be the sort of thing that we intend, nonetheless are random enough, and in that randomness, as it combines with the mechanistic intention that we have as individuals and in our minds, the combination of those two things creates the free will that we enjoy. So that's how that works. And it's quantum because it's random at the lowest level, and it's also mechanistic because it's mechanistic at another level, at the level that we see. And it might even be operable on a larger macro scale as well, but we're not going into that level just yet. but between those two things, what you find is an interaction between these two seemingly opposed principles that, of their own, would operate and create a universe, each one of them. But they're like a Venn diagram of two circles intersecting. Where they intersect is where we are, and that's where that comes about. And so this also leads to the question: okay, well, why is there anything at all? And I've often thought this and talked with it with friends. You know, you get high and, I mean, go on and on about all this stuff. And I did many times when I was younger. Ultimately to the point of brainstorming such that I get to the level here where I've done enough contemplation on these topics that I can give you the fruits of my labors, you might say. Why is there anything at all? It goes back to the question of, and physicists bring this up at the beginning, that there's antimatter and there's matter. And when you create, when you have antimatter, let's say you have an antiproton and you have a regular proton, and when they hit each other, when they get near each other, they explode in a tremendous release of energy. Because they're diametrically opposed to each other, basically. One is spinning. You might say that one is spinning in one direction, the other is spinning in the other direction. And in such a manner that as they, when they come together like that, they annihilate each other. Now, this is, that exact spin is, what is that? Now, at the same time, they're trying to figure that out in the physical sciences, perhaps through experimentation or otherwise. Once you get down to that level, you start to run into Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where you're trying to figure out the nature and interaction of a singular particle by hitting it with some other particle. And when you hit it with that some other particle, the you hitting it there and looking at the response that it has alters what the original thing was doing, and it's anyway, it gets very sticky by that point. Experimental physicists these days are very clever though, and they found ways to isolate these experiments such that they can have a better idea of how these things work. But At the beginning, and this is one of the running theories for the beginning of the universe, is that you had a creation that when you split something down the middle, like let's say there was the beginning of our universe is one singular ball of tightly bound energy. Like a yin and yang ball rotated around itself in a thousand different ways, and was tight and solid. And then you split that thing. What you create is antimatter and matter. So if you have that which is positive and you have that which is negative, the release of them, You would think that as they then interact, they're going to annihilate each other equally, and what you're going to have is just pure energy left over. But that's not the case, as we can see. That ultimately life finds a way through this, and there is one sort of slight edge up that ends up being the prevailing force, or becoming the prevailing matter that that then, you know, spreads out and becomes what we see, this universe. And likely it's just a small little 1% on top of that. So you got 51% matter and 49% antimatter, and the interaction between them ends up leaving a tiny amount of matter and a whole lot of energy that that permeates throughout this continuum, throughout this universe. And and then once you could get a little deeper to this too after that and be like, okay, well, that matter itself might be itself energy that is even more tightly bound in such a manner that when we look at it, it seems like a solid thing, but it's really just a more tightly bound form of energy and holding right there. So that's where that can be. And that brings up the possibility that the whole thing is all a swirling sort of energy, that each one of these individual material particles is as if a whirlpool, a small little whirlpool in the eddies of a river that are notable, and that we can identify them, but they ultimately are made of the water that the rest of the river is. And if you see that when one whirlpool runs into another whirlpool and they happen to be going in opposite directions, what happens? They destroy each other, and there's no more whirlpool, and it's just water. So this is, I believe, where Einstein was running into his cosmological constant, what they call a quintessence, that which you can also look at and see a parallel in the cosmic microwave background radiation, or what they used to call the ether back in the late 1800s, that there's similar to us walking through life in the atmosphere of air, that we're nonetheless in the midst of. They posit that that this ether is sort of like an air that that provides the background for all the universe. So whether it's in space, or whether it's underground, or you're in water, or you're in air, or you're a living being made of material, made of what you are, that ether would permeate through everything and have some sort of effect. And they say that Einstein looked at his cosmological constant, and he said that it was one of his biggest mistakes. Now, I don't know how it can be a mistake to just explore an idea, but nonetheless, he seemed to think that he spent too much time on it, at the very least, and then he had other things that he could have been more focused on. But since then, we've also heard of such a thing called dark energy, and these are all aspects of the same principle that has various different names, and that there is experimental observations that tend to and lead to this as a some sort of conclusion, that there is this background of sorts to the universe and to the matter and the energy that that we can witness. And how that interacts, we don't know. And what exactly it's made of, we don't know. But nonetheless, this is another mystery that is presently, if I'm not mistaken, at the forefront of the of physics and cosmology that they're still working at. But the way I see it is that portions of that might very well be layers of different types of energy in a similar manner that there might very well be a layer of energy above the cosmic microwave background radiation that you could say is possibly even more universal. And this might be something that throws into the multiverse theory as well. Now, if there is some way that we can utilize multiverse theory in order to benefit us in our own universe, well, we would have to have some sort of connection to those other universes. We have to have some sort of connection to these other worlds that are seemingly completely disconnected from us. It's a thought experiment that we can utilize in order to posit that there are these, quite possibly these other universes. But if there's no real connection that we can draw to them, then all it's ever going to be is a thought experiment, and there won't be any way to experiment on it and find out if there's something really there. But looking at this in the sense that there might be a larger energy that permeates through our universe, that also permeates through other universes, might be the very thing that allows us to, let's say, observe those other universes, and to utilize this multiverse theory in some sort of practical manner to benefit us. So, see where we go with that. Have fun with that idea. Yeah, I think that'll probably conclude the physics physics lesson for the day, or you might say speculations on that front. But ultimately, what I end up seeing and what to take away from this is that life and our free will is, so far as I can tell, an interaction between the quantum randomness and the real-world cause and effect continuum. And there's a continuum and interaction between them that goes back and forth that ultimately turns out to we can have control of, at least to a small extent in our own lives. And at that, there's a small little 1% edge on life and on our, you might say, conscious minds and self-determinable parts of our souls that allow us to have a bit of control on that front, and to do, to some certain extent, what we wish, as opposed to being cogs in a machine that some would say are just on the receiving end of a lot of slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Now, there's something else that I wanted to bring up today as well, and this has to do with something a little more practical. We'll get down to some political aspects here of things. Namely, there has been a tendency, because what we're doing now, since we are on the cusp of, and it's occurring as it is, that we're creating a new world, whether you like it or not. it's happening, my friends. And it's up to each one of us to add and what we want it to be. So we really are in a position where we're creating the world that we want to see. And the responsibility lies on us to create what we wish. Now, we can look at the tendencies of the governmental and technological and psychological approaches that we've had in the past to where we've grown up, let's say the last 100 years, that sort of thing. And the observations that we make that seemed so, that in some cases seem so absolute and unchangeable, that sort of thing, are really changeable. They really are. Similar to what I brought up last week when I was discussing the fact that much of our money is made from the faith and credit of the person who signs on that contract, that dotted line, and says, hey, I'm going to pay you $2,000 a month for 10 years. Well, their good word on that front ultimately is what underlies and what underpins the economic system that we have today. Because in such a manner, you can see the relation to which our economy itself and our monetary system itself ultimately comes down to each one of us and our fortitude and our fidelity in how we do what we say we're going to do. And so when you look at it that way, you do realize that we have the power here. It is our fidelity and faith and credit that underwrites this whole thing, every one of us. And so if we want, this goes back to that be the change type of thing, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. And at that, do what it is that you really feel is best to do, you know, for you or for your family. This is something that that I'd like to, I need to remember to ask folks for interviews, is to ask especially, for who is it that you do what you do? Who is it? Do you do it for yourself? Do you do it for your partner? Do you do it for your kids? Do you do it for your community? Do you do it for some lofty purpose that might not even necessarily be relatable to any particular person or even an animal or whatever? Or what other rationale does one have for this? Because identifying that is the way to identify what your real desires are. At least lead one on toward that end, such that we can be that much more honest with ourselves. And as we create this new world we're going into, and hang on, keep the good things that we've had in the past, and get rid of the garbage. That's vital for us to understand what it is that one really wants. And when you find that out, then you have that sense that there's that much more better sense of that fidelity, that faith, and that credit. What it is and where it is that you're going and what you're doing is extremely relevant to you continuing to do such things. To know what it is that drives you will make your signature when you sign on that dotted line that much more important. And when we all do that, when we all have a decent understanding of where we're coming from and what we're doing, then we create that better economy for ourselves. And we create that world about us. Because that's the only way it really comes about. Somebody has to put themselves on the line and say, hey, you know, I'm going to do this thing. And they go do it. If people believe him, great. And if he does it, great. You know, if he doesn't, and it doesn't turn out that way, then that's a shame. Then you got to find someone else who does. And this ultimately, in such a manner, we find what it is in a community basis that ends up being beneficial to us. So you take that one situation and you create and you look at it in the aggregate, and you see that this sort of thing happens all the time, over and over and over again, in just about everyone's life, repeatedly, on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis. and that aggregation of all these different interactions and the faith and fidelity that each one of us individuals have in our interactions themselves ends up creating that community that then creates that larger economy. And for those that this is why they say that the kingdom of God is inside you. That's why it is, because ultimately it comes down to each one of us to be that thing that we'd like to see in the world, to underwrite that world that we would like to live in. And I think what I'm getting at here too is another formulation, or you might say codification, of that golden rule: treat others as you would like to be treated yourself. And it almost works in the opposite manner as well. Treat yourself as you would like others to treat themselves. It's not necessarily an opposite matter. This is a complementary way in which this works. And there is a codification there that is very beneficial for us. And the best ideas really are short and understandable. That's why, why is it that we had this constitution in our country that has lasted for 250 years longer than any other country? Is because it really is simple and readable, and that you can understand it. Not that lawyer up on the hill there, not necessarily the politician in the state house, not necessarily anyone else. But if you have the ability to read, you can read and understand this. You can read and understand that Constitution, and as such, when you do and you see how it works, not just for yourself, but how it works when others accept it as well, that's when the sense that our individual lives, as we treat ourselves, ends up becoming the society in which we want to see. Because if you get too far into this, into the collectivist mindset, what happens is that you divorce yourself from your ability to have any effect on things. And that's one of the great ruses behind much of what is referred to as a communist thought or a socialist thought, is that you get enough people together who say, okay, we all want this, we all want this, and then the leader's like, oh, okay, you want that, well, I'll give you that, and they're like, okay, great, and then the leader goes to work and he starts giving the people that. And the people find out that in order for them to get that, they have to be used by the leader in ways that they didn't want originally. And then it becomes, okay, well, then it's all this group thing. And then their actual, like what they can do with their own lives and their independent and individuality becomes stymied. And it doesn't affect what happens anymore because they gave away their sovereignty on that front for a collectivist ideal that in the act of making that thing that they all wanted, they end up losing their ability to determine their own lives. And When you get to that level, you're not necessarily a. This is why for humanity they say that man is the measure of all things. I think this was a quote. It's been quoted elsewise, but thousands of years it's been around. And also that, I mean, that's why the buck needs to stop with us. Because if you create these systems that are collectivist, that are bigger than that, that are expressly bigger than that, and you end up losing your position as a human being to determine your own fate. And this is vital for us to hang on to. Now, there's plenty of practical reasons for us to have larger organizations and structures and government itself. Plenty of practical reasons for that. And it's helpful in a lot of ways. This is why our Constitution is so vital, is because it allows for that on a governmental level. It allows for us to come together and organize and do things that are beneficial for the group. While retaining the individual rights and personal sovereignty that we have, because if you don't have that anymore, we become this giant blob, this amoeba of humanity that flows like a in its own manner. There's no more. There's not necessarily any more handle that any individual can have on it. And this is very ugly in our own lives when that sort of thing happens. It's not the place that humans were meant to be, and it's not the way that we were meant to live. Now, how we get to a better world and still organize each other and come together in groups and work for our common good while at the same time retaining that individual deterministic manner of which we have responsibility and ability to better the society that we live in, and to live our lives the way in which we want. Finding a balance between them is difficult, but when you find it, it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And in a lot of ways, we've had that in our country, it's always under threat, that balance, in a sense. Now, if I were to pick one way or the other, I would go the realm of more individuality than the collectivist thinking. But that's me. Ultimately, a balance between them is vital, and I think anyone can agree on that. Now, one of the things that happens with this, this is an observation of the system that we have had, let's say in the 20th century particularly, but doesn't necessarily need to be the way that we operate in the future. And something I noticed when it came to technology and regulation and productivity is this. With every increase in productivity that came from technology, say that you had a widget that allowed what was prior in order for you to do your job, let's say a razor blade. In order to make a razor blade, you needed five people, and you needed one day. You needed one day, and you needed five people in order to make that razor blade. Suddenly a widget got invented such that you only need two people in one day in order to make that razor blade. So that's massively increased productivity, which is great. This is a positive thing. There's when that has happened in the much of the 20th century, when you had an increased technological productivity that came about as a result of that, there was a corresponding increase in regulation that what would have, let's say in this case, you could have kept those five workers, and instead of them working for working 8 hours straight all those days, each one of them could work 3 hours. And at the same time, you finish the same thing, and if all other metrics stay the same, ultimately they're still getting paid what they were making before. But they just have more free time and more leisure time as a result of that. Now, if you take that and you add it into the aggregate, what you notice is that on a societal level, we have gone to extremes on that front, where rather than keeping those five workers and shortening the hours down to three and then having the same pay, the market, well, not necessarily market forces, but the individuals who were running that company realized, oh, we can make more money if we get rid of three of the workers and then keep two of them, and then they could do that work, and then they'll basically get a higher slice of the pie, a bigger slice of the pie. And that's perpetuated. That's a tendency that's just gone on and on and on until we've gotten to a level, and so far as I've seen, it looks like people are really standing up for themselves when it comes to working conditions and what they're being asked to do and the amount of money that they're being paid and all that sort of thing. And this is great, because this is self-empowerment. It really is. It's a wonderful thing to see this happening at a more base level. Now, who exactly is doing it? Why are they doing it? Everybody has their own reasons, but when you are taking control of your own life and saying that I have value and I deserve respect, everybody wins in that case. They do, regardless of what side you're on that front. If you're the person hiring them or paying for them, or you're the person who's actually working, or you're the quasi-neutral party who is willing to, let's say that you want to buy the thing that they're making, you still win on that as well. Really, everyone does when that's the case in the end. It's mostly short-sighted thinking that ends up being the stopper to that sort of thinking. But anyway, it's good to see that happening, and that's a positive thing. If you look in the long term, in the long game here, that's where we're in good shape. And the more that people stand up for themselves and say, hey, I'm not going to get treated like this, then the better. Whether you're talking about impositions and the mandates, which are clearly unconstitutional, whether you're talking about working conditions themselves, whether you're talking about how much someone gets paid for factory work at, say, or in warehouse work like at Amazon, etc., or for truckers, or really just about anybody. Such a thing also increases the likelihood that we have entrepreneurship come about as well, because if someone realizes, hey, I don't need to work for this trucking company, I have the connections myself to talk to the people who supply what I need to transport and those who want to buy it. If you have those connections yourself, you can start your own company, and you can go with that. Then you can really be your own man. Now, this is something that really anybody can do across industries. Some industries it's more difficult. Some industries it's easier, just depending on what sort of access you have to things, how many people is necessary in order to create this particular product or to do this particular service, that sort of thing. But when people stand up for themselves and do that, it's a win all across the board, because the people who are making the thing and doing the service are no longer, they don't have that overhead anymore, and you don't have someone breathing down your neck to have limited gains. So you can set your own hours and work the way that you wish to do in so many manners, just as an example. But this is really positive. And one of the things that happens as a... This tendency, the other tendency, to go back to the other point, is that the regulation that operates to tamp down the increased productivity. And we're going to take a break for one moment, and we'll be right back. So, considering that tendency for an increased regulation with increased productivity technologically, and also other ways in which productivity can be increased as well, that is unfortunately something that reduces our ability to determine what it is that we do in our work lives and how it is what we get paid to do and what's appropriate for that increase in productivity. And there's also the tendency of planned obsolescence as well, which is something that has been going on for a very long time in our country, and unfortunately goes against the principle of quality over quantity. And so you end up with this, ultimately, it's a damn shame it's the case, this plastic garbage made in China that falls apart after 1 year. It really is unfortunate that that has become a tendency in our system. And by looking at that, you can look at that and see that purely as one solid Exhibit A evidence that that what we're doing, what we have been doing, that is to say, is not good. That it's not beneficial. And we've been getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed ever more as the years have pressed on in a labor and working sort of conditioned manner, even though there have been massive, massive productivity gains. And the amount of money that we were getting paid rarely increased at all. And this is the strange thing, is that with each one of those regulations ends up coming bigger and bigger bureaucracies, such that those bureaucracies and those regulations end up creating more and more of a bloat of a bureaucratic class. And when you might be making a lot of money in there, and you might be getting paid well, but what are you really doing in that sort of position? Especially when that position is created really just because, and at a deep sort of level, and when it comes to planned obsolescence, this is what happens, is that the companies that intentionally make a substandard product such that it falls apart after 2 years, such that you have to go out there and buy another substandard product, the reason they do that is so that they can stay in, they are certain, they have this absolute certainty that they're going to stay in business. Because originally you look at those light bulbs and you're like, okay, well, these, we know that we can keep making light bulbs, the light bulb factory, and we can keep employing people making the light bulbs if we make sure the light bulbs go out after 2 years. So then people have to come in, they have to buy more light bulbs, right? Well, ultimately what underlies that tendency of that planned obsolescence in order to make those substandard products is because the company and the people involved, particularly, are scared. They think that once, if they make all these light bulbs that last forever, that last for 20 years, for instance, and that everyone buys plenty of them, and they have all the light bulbs they need for the rest of their lives, that company would necessarily go under. Now, why would it go under? Why would it go under? Why would you necessarily say, okay, well, everyone has all the light bulbs, so you can all go home? No. At that point, you have yourself an incredible infrastructure for building a product. You have a huge team of people who you know can work very well. You have connections with the retailers, with the people who produce the things. You have everything to make a new product that people will desire, that they might need at some point. Now, if you're short on ideas of what to do, then all you need to do is go out there and find some creative people, and they'll help you out. I mean, they're out there. I meet them all the time. I meet them every day. And so much of the time, these creative people, especially these days, have been absolutely just driven mad by the fact that they have all these. For me, in a lot of cases too, I've gone pretty wild occasionally, just because when you have all these ideas, and they're all great. Well, not all of them, but when you have an incredible amount of ideas and you're just this, you know, creative force, and you don't have an outlet for it, or in many cases you don't get paid to do it, and in many cases society itself wants you to stop creating, so it would seem, our society prior, for the last 100 years, and it almost looks like that these forces at the top that have become so corrupt just want you to stop creating at all, and to take people who are interested in doing that sort of thing, and just either turn them into a cog in the machine or crush them entirely. It's not fun. It's not fun to live in this set of circumstances when that's the case. But the reason that you look at that, and when you see that the planned obsolescence comes from fear of those, the owners and the workers and others who are unsure of what to do if the product that they make is so good that they don't need to make any more of it. But at the same time, they're buying out and they're stopping other competition through, you know, various monopolistic practices. You can see that if you combine, if you add the faith that what you're doing and the product that you make, and that you will be able to make a product and people will buy it, if you add that along with the creative people who've been stunted and shoved out of the market, you combine those two things, you gain that faith, and you bring in those creative people, and you have a whole lot of folks who know how to make a product and to make a factory work, that sort of thing. You combine those, and you're golden. You can't go wrong in this case. And in every person within this example, when they have faith in themselves, when they have faith in the people around them, they all benefit. Everyone benefits on this front. And you end up with people who love to do what they do, who love to make what they want to make. You have people who are interested in whatever it is that they're doing, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I've seen this on small scales in this country, and I'd love to see it more. Unfortunately, a lot of that was attacked with the virus panic. But I think that we have the ability to step it up, to rise out of the ashes of this tremendous attack on the human spirit and make a better world for ourselves. Even if it's only 51% against 49, 51% will win. So on that note, I'll leave you to it. On the GT Maverick, coming to you from Westport, Kansas City, Missouri. This is October 27th, 2021. Wishing you peace, love, harmony, justice, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.